agenda, we may as well get started. So welcome, I guess formally calling us to order now for our April Board of Governors meeting. And just, I guess, a few things off the top, just by way of President's report, a few updates and I guess a few recitations of things passed. First thing I just thought I'd mention to everybody is that Ellen and I had an opportunity recently to sign a letter endorsing some of the efforts of the Access to Justice Initiative and the DC Bar Justice Commission's efforts to bring in more funding from the city and in support of some of the amazing programs that the bar participates in and helps lead, which you're all well familiar with. At last count, that letter had the support of 30 past presidents as well. So there was a great groundswell of support for the bar's continuing efforts in this area. And of course, we can hope that the city continues to fund robustly all the important work that those entities do. So it was nice to be able to at least show a bit of support and press good arguments forward on their behalf. I thought I'd just remind everyone that we have a special membership meeting upcoming on the 27th of April. Again, that's at 4 p.m. by way of Zoom. And that is the meeting where we'll undertake the three historical resolutions that the bar has supported in the area of public statements on various issues that are germane to the profession. And we'll also undertake a consideration with the members of a new resolution in the area of public statements concerning judicial independence and the rule of law and support for those issues. Again, that resolution is intended to be used sparingly as all the others are, and it is not intended to get us into partisan arguments or debates, but it's really just support broadly, along lines, frankly, that the bar has done and has undertaken in the past in respect of supporting the need to fill judicial vacancies in a timely and efficient manner, and again, broadly to support rule of law issues and efforts. So it'll be an interesting and I'm guessing broad-ranging discussion on the 27th, and I hope you can all participate and join. I thought it would be worth noting, I don't think anyone from the board, well, Ellen, I know you were on the call last week for the Bar Spring Wellness Fair. I'm not sure if anyone else was able to join from the board, but I just thought I'd note it was really a fascinating series of sessions last Thursday. Some really thought-provoking presentations in the area of sort of the mind-body connection and how to sort of leverage each against the other to help deal with burnout and stress and so many of the challenges that we've all faced over the course of the last 2 years. And I thought it was particularly interesting and timely because I think we're all starting to face new challenges as we return to offices and buildings and to whatever extent, your practices or your organizations are having that happen. So it was just some really insightful and experienced practitioners in various areas. There's some really practical information as well concerning sort of financial advice and how to manage the paperwork and the burdens associated with some of our financial obligations as legal professionals. So it was really just a fabulous day overall, and just another example of the incredible work that our bar staff and guest speakers, et cetera, are able to put out and put on for our members. Really a good, great value added day. So cheers to all the bar staff who made that happen. I guess I would like to turn to you, Ellen, if you could give maybe just a little bit of an update, given your recent attendance at the ABA's Bar Leadership Institute.
Sure, happy to, Chad, and also happy to be on video. I don't know what happened, but good to be joining you all. Yeah, absolutely. About a month ago, I guess in March, Bob and Darren and I attended the ABA Bar Leadership Institute in Chicago. It's a couple days where bar leaders from all over the country, voluntary bars, mandatory bars, affinity bars, state bars, come together and have 2 days of networking and programming And it was just a wonderful, wonderful experience. I had been many years ago before when I was president-elect of the Women's Bar. So it was really fabulous to see kind of the sophistication and the change and the growth in this event. It was really, really fabulous. It was also wonderful to network with other folks. We had the ABA president, Reg Turner, the president-elect there presenting. So it was a really great opportunity to make those connections as well. The programs were terrific, really, really interesting. They were anything from, you know, corporate governance, you know, practices that bar associations might want to adopt to, you know, move meetings along, to make sure you recognize all the voices in the room, to try to maximize your time together, to honing your message as a bar, communications, marketing, you know, what, how do you go out to your membership? What do you emphasize? Also some very interesting programs on just nuts and bolts, finances, demographics, the growth in the young members that we're seeing, how to reach those young members and get them involved. It was just a real terrific, terrific 2 days. And it was also wonderful to see how our bar rocks and rolls at these national events. Bob is on the standing committee for bar leadership. And he was, not only did he have programs where he was one of the presenters, which is awesome for us to get that exposure, but there was even a program where he was asked to step in at the last minute for a presenter who wasn't able to be there. And it was amazing. I was so proud of Bob. It was as though he had been planning to do this program all along. Totally seamless, totally awesome. It was really, really a wonderful experience. And an added benefit was for some of the sessions, they grouped us according to, you know, whether you were a mandatory bar and what your size was. So for many of the sessions, we were grouped with other mandatory bars of, they're mostly smaller except for Texas, but 30,000 and up was kind of our cutoff. So we were with Texas and Washington and also some smaller mandatory bars. So it was really fun to be able to connect with those leaders and talk about issues that we see in common that we're facing and how we provide services and value to our members. So it was a really, really wonderful 2 days, chock full, packed full.
Ellen, thanks for that update. And I think we picked just the perfect time in the program to turn to you for it, because I see that Chief Judge Anita Josie Herring just joined us. And so I hope that she also took a moment to revel in those great notes and to hear what great things our bar is doing on the district's behalf. Welcome, Chief Judge Josie Herring.
Thank you very much. And I'm so happy that I'm able to join today. And it sounds very exciting. The bar is doing great things. We are pleased to continue working with the bar, and you've been such a help as we continue to navigate through this process of emerging from the pandemic and helping with pro bono matters in particular.
Absolutely. It's our pleasure to have you, and it's our pleasure to support your efforts, Your Honor. And you, I think you may have joined just after an update I provided for the board with regard to the bar's recent letter of support to the Access to Justice initiative in the commission. So, we remain in that boat with you and pulling on the oars, hopefully in the same direction at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Go ahead. I was going to ask, do you want to give a little bit of an update or not?
We can take a pause. I have two more items on my list, but okay. We can certainly take a pause on those.
No. I will. No, it's your agenda. I'm happy to wait my turn. Okay.
Okay. Well, I'll be brief with these last two items then, Your Honor, and maybe we can turn to you then. So I just thought hopefully you're all aware, but the Pro Bono Center's annual fundraising effort is underway. I hope you've gotten that word. This is all in support of the 2022 President's Reception and for the benefit of the Pro Bono Center, and certainly to honor our own President-elect, Ellen Jakovic. Some of you are participating on her All-Star Development Committee, who are helping really just make a fabulous push in support of the Pro Bono Center. In fact, I believe they've set out a fabulous goal of $1 million in that we are already about 43% of the way there. So this is just a reminder of that effort of foot and a bit of a call for you each to make a generous gift in support of the Pro Bono Center, to ask your organizations or your firms to support the center and its critical needs in working to help support low-income residents and small businesses and nonprofit organizations all across the city. I think most of you are aware that we always aim for 100% participation from our Board of Governor members. I guess just by way of recognition notes, pledges and contributions of $250 or more that are received by May 6th will actually be recognized in the invitation and marketing materials for the event in June. And in individual contributions of $1,000 or more and law firm or corporate contributions of $5,000 or more will be recognized in a special ad that appears in the July Washington Lawyer, which you may recall from last summer. I think you've heard the Pro Bono Center say before that these contributions in support of the president's reception raise about a quarter of the center's in total budget every single year. So it's just a critical time and a critical effort afoot. Our own Angela Boone, who you've heard from in many of these meetings in the past, is available to accept pledges and to provide more information. You can always reach out to her. There's also the ability to use the website and contribute online. The very last item I thought I'd put in my president's report is probably the happiest news and one of the most fun things I've gotten to do so far this year, and that is to select winners for two of the bar's important awards, the Marshall Award and the Rosenberg Award. And this year, I selected Judith Sandalo of the Children's Law Center to receive the Marshall Award. I suspect many of you are well familiar with her incredible record and career and contributions in the area of protecting children in so many different ways across the city. She has seen the Children's Law Center grow. She's overseen its growth from a staff of like 3 to north of 90. She has been instrumental in legislative and advocacy efforts on so many different issues. She is just fully vested in the work of the center in that area of law. And she quickly jumped out for the group and to me as a worthy recipient of this year's award. So it was really just a treat to be able to make that call and to give her the good news. And she's incredibly grateful for the recognition, of course. Similarly, it was a pleasure to reach out to Susan Pascasello at the USAID and inform her that she had selected her for the Rosenberg Award. Susan has been with, much like Judith, Susan has been with USAID for more than 2 decades. She's been incredibly instrumental in a series of initiatives related to the international development world, accounting for risks and problems associated with sexual exploitation and abuse in that community. She's undertaken a number of sort of strategic planning initiatives to address those problems and others. She served as an incredible mentor for younger lawyers at USAID. She has implemented a program that's seen incredible growth of USAID's legal presence outside the United States. There's something of she oversees about 60 lawyers who do USAID's work outside the U.S. Just an incredible lawyer, an incredible counselor, and an incredible mentor and teacher within the government arena. And she also stood out pretty broadly for her incredible contributions and achievements. So it was, again, just a treat to be able to call her and give her that good news. So that all being said, maybe I should turn back to you, Chief Judge Josie Herring, and ask for any comments or contributions you'd like to make.
Thank you thank you very much. And I, first of all, it's exciting to hear that Judith Sandalo is getting this award. She has been working very, very hard in this area for really some decades now. And so she does awesome work. So what a wonderful person to honor. And I must say, I don't know Ms. Pistello in the same way I do know Judith because of working with her over the years. And I know she's excited about this honor. In terms of the court, I just wanted to update you that on April the 8th, when our general order regarding court operations was due to expire, I should say before that, we issued an amended order that goes until June the 10th. And essentially, we're continuing in stages to bring back judicial officers and staff to the court. The criminal division folks have been here since some of them, you know, as early as April of last year, but we have a full cadre of judges and staff in the criminal division and have had them working full time. They're disposing of cases, and we are trying to sort of get the bar sort of accustomed to really pushing cases forward again. We have had a little bit of reluctance. People aren't necessarily ready to get back in the queue the way they were, but we are trying to move the trials or certainly the dispositions, however the case is disposed of, whether it's by plea or trial. We've picked that up a tremendous amount really in the last 4 months. It's just been incredible, the progress that the judges are making there. We also have judges handling juvenile cases to come in when they're trying cases in person. And the juvenile judges handling juvenile cases in the family court that are delinquency cases involving criminal conduct that is called delinquency because they're juveniles, those judges will all permanently be back in the courthouse in 60 days, as well as the judges handling domestic relations cases and the judges handling child support cases. At the end of June, we will have the civil division judges who are doing the work virtually coming back. We have outfitted most of the courtrooms on the criminal side. We're staging it, well, all of the courtrooms on the criminal side because all those judges are back. But because we're going to have a variety of in-person, hybrid, or exclusively virtual proceedings in every division of the court, part of what is delaying getting people back sooner is our need to outfit every courtroom for those varying types of hearings, you know, that are not in person, and to make sure that we have the bandwidth, right, to support the degree to which our Wi-Fi will be taxed once everyone is here, as opposed to working from their homes or some other places. So we're doing it, bringing people back as we deem the priorities are here in the court. There's a lot happening on the juvenile justice front. So that's it's important to get those judges back. The domestic relations cases are very sticky because they involve custody, although they involve divorce. We want to make sure we get those judges back because sometimes there are exchanges of children that need to happen. And we want the judges to be on site where that can happen pretty promptly and us not have to make arrangements for judges to come in, although they've had a virtual hearing, to have people exchange and have that delay. So we're getting those judges back in. We're getting the judges in that do child support because not in all cases, meaning there are lots of agreements in child support cases amongst the parties. We have people on site to mediate and work with individuals who are not represented in child support cases and coming to agreements about those orders. And we have people from OAJG here to run the numbers on the cases to see what the order of payment should be. But there are times when people are not compliant and there's no reason that we can support not ask, having judges step them back. And so those cases need to come back so that they're properly handled. And so we have all of our work happening either in person or virtually. So there's nothing that's not being covered. We have the probate and tax division. The judges will come in if they have a trial that is, and they don't likely have a lot of them, some of the proceedings in tax are jury demandable. And so the judges can come in for any jury trial in every division that occurs. For example, civil has designated courtrooms for jury trials. And so while they're doing most of their work virtually, when the judges have jury trials, they go to one of our other court buildings, A or B, and we kind of put those functions in other superior court buildings that were separate so that if we have a big COVID breakout, everybody's not impacted because it spreads in one place. So we've sort of separated some of our functions out. And DV is, a lot is still happening virtually, but the criminal trials, when the misdemeanor DV trials, criminal trials are happening in person, but otherwise the CPO hearings and things of that nature are happening virtually. Those judges will be back in 60 days. We've given 60 days, for some of our functions to return, because even if we have the courtrooms together in terms of the technology, we know people have to make adjustments and arrangements in their lives given the transition back. And so we want to give everyone a chance to do that because we have, you know, not only the judges, but court staff and everybody mm-hmm. else who's impacted by our return to work transitions back. I want to say that the great news is that we have vetted with every stakeholder group that we know of. Our reimagining the court plan, and every division has been working on that plan since midway through 2021. And it's been continually, those plans have been continually tweaked as we gain input from stakeholders and, you know, internal and external. And those plans are really 99% done. Every division's plan is set except civil. There's a little tweaking that they're doing, but they've met with all of the stakeholder groups. I've met with them, with some of the stakeholder groups. And so we're excited to say on the issue of access to justice, we're really taking a broad approach to ensuring that people can participate in court hearings by virtually. We obviously have some remote sites in the community. Other people participate by using their cell phones. There are many ways that people can participate in hearings. And we find that there's better court attendance when that happens. It's obviously easier for people rather than having to take off work or park down here or take buses or whatever for some short hearings. And the bar has really appreciated it across the board. Obviously, with our jury trials, we want to do those in person. And there's some other evidentiary hearings that we will require to be done in person unless everybody waives. And, you know, people may have a strong view about something for a particular reason. We have made the standard low, kept the standard low. For judges, you know, really to opt into a virtual proceeding if we've designated it as in-person, if all of the parties agree. And we've also, in the reverse, made it easy for judges to listen to the parties in the case and opt into an in-person proceeding if people prefer to have it. And so I think it's going to be great. I mean, it all has to mesh, right? And so that's another reason why we're bringing people back in stages so that we can see, in addition to taxing our technology and measuring whether we can do what we imagined and put in writing, what corrections or tweaks we need to do with technology as before we bring yet another group or subject area of cases in. With the judges and staff attached to that. So it's a really exciting time for us. And we hope that the variant doesn't affect us or the city in a way that causes us to have to contract. We are maintaining, I call it the infrastructure, but the courtrooms that we have associate it with other courtrooms for jurors to sit in a courtroom which is bigger to deliberate as opposed to in a smaller jury room, and some of the other physical accommodations we've made to spread people out will remain in place. And so if we have to contract, it'll just be easier for us to do it as a practical matter. But we are reducing the distancing requirements to 4 feet. In our courthouse, we will maintain the mask requirement. People are misunderstand, for example, the requirement some people that the mayor has. I mean, her order does require that for large settings, essentially in public buildings or agencies, that people still wear masks. Some people say, oh no, there's no city requirement anymore. It's not the case if you read the fine print. It's not in general, but there are some exceptions. The court is free to set, you know, its own rules around this. We have an epidemiologist and an environmental hygienist on contract who advise us. We also look at the CDC guidance and get other information about what the city's doing, what's happening with variants and so on. And we have decided that we will maintain the mask requirement until we later determine it's not needed. As we're bringing people back, the mask requirement will remain in place, but otherwise we'll continue reducing the distancing requirements as the COVID positivity rates get lower and lower. But, you know, obviously we don't know what the future holds, and so we will make adjustments as we need to. So that's where we are. We brought on 5 new judges, and thank you for all the work that you have done, President Sargio and others, to push for us to get additional judges. And so we were down 18 judges, and so we got 5. But unfortunately, before the end of the year, there were 3 leaving. Now there, I'm aware that there are 5 leaving. So we will be back down 18 probably by August. We've already lost 1 judge as of the end of March. We'll lose another judge probably as of mid-May. And, you know, and so between then and the end of August, the 5 judges anticipated who have informed me they will be leaving will be gone. So this is the most critical issue for us at this time to continue to push now that the Supreme Court nominee has been appointed to the Supreme Court as a Supreme Court justice. We figure we can get a little bit of daylight with the Senate. We have 5 people pending there. And it is critical for those people to move because our caseloads are super high and it's hard, obviously. We, 3 of the people that were elevated to associate judges were magistrates. So we will name tomorrow 3 additional people. They've been vetted through a committee, a couple of committees actually. I've interviewed them as well. And so 3 magistrate judges will be named tomorrow. It'll take them about 1.5 to 2 months to really be ready to go to a courtroom. They'll have 1 month of training and they'll have to give notice and all of that. So we were fortunate in our appropriations to get 2 additional magistrate judge positions, but of course, because they have limited jurisdiction, we can't utilize them in the same way that we'd like to pick up some more of the responsibility when we're down associate judges. So we've relied heavily on our senior judges, but they max out. They can't make more than a currently sitting judge. And so even if we have more work statutorily, we have to stop giving them cases at some point. So we're really doing a big balancing act. But we're happy for any assistance that we can get from the bar to keep the judges coming because we'll be back in the situation we were in before we got the five very soon.
Well, thank you so much for that update, Your Honor. There's a lot of good news there, even if a few cautionary tales, but certainly you can count on the bar for continued support. And I think all of us truly appreciate how many moving parts you're dealing with there. And we certainly respect the thoughtful approach you're taking to ensuring justice and safety and so many other competing interests. So thank you so much for all of that. And absolutely, you can count on us going forward.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Before I move off of the president's report entirely, Ellen, I just wanted to check with you and see if you had any other thoughts you wanted to share with the group on the reception.
Thank you, Chad. I just wanted to echo, Chad, your thanks to everyone who is serving on the development committee, especially our co-chairs, past president Susie Hoffman and Tib Webster. We are really off to a fabulous start. And we have many members of our board who are helping, and thanks to them as well. Those of you who were on the board when Susie Hoffman was president-elect may remember that she offered to bake her famous banana bread for everyone on the board who contributed, in whether monetarily or by getting their firms to donate or organizations to the president's reception, which is so important for making sure that our pro bono center has the funds it needs to go forward. So I am not the cook that Susie is, and I do not have a fabulous banana bread recipe, but my son has always loved my pumpkin chocolate chip muffins. So we are planning to be in person for our June meeting, and I will bring a selection of pumpkin chocolate chip muffins for everyone to enjoy who helps support the pro bono president's reception. So perhaps a little added plus for folks to make sure that we get out the word, get out the dollars for the pro bono center, which, as you know, we really need to have those funds to help to assuage the great need in the community, especially in the wake of the pandemic. So thank you for that. I also wanted to add, I think Judge Josie Herring has left us, but if she's still with us, and just for the board to know, I want to congratulate. Oh, you are wonderful. I guess you're just off. Oh, there you are. You were off my screen for a minute.
Okay.
Judge Josie Herring, I want to congratulate you on being honored this year as the Women Bar's Women Lawyer of the Year. It's a wonderful honor. We are so tremendously thankful of the work that you do in our community, and we look forward to celebrating you on May 19th at the Women's Bar Annual Dinner. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and it's a wonderful honor, and it's so pleasing, especially in difficult times, because sometimes you feel like you're not getting anything done, and so it's helpful. We're doing something, all of us working together, and so thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, the Women's Bar is delighted to honor you.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Your Honor. Ellen, yeah, it sounds like a great plan. It's not going to work out for you, though, because I have pretty sharp elbows. I'll be around those pumpkin chocolate chip muffins. So, but good luck. With that, then Katie, I see your hand raised.
I did also just want to share kudos to the judge, because I just tried a very complex medical malpractice case in person with a jury. We selected the jury over in Building B, and everything was frankly flawless. And I just wanted to say, from my point of view, it's amazing what you've done and the efforts that I know it took for us to bring that case to trial. And I can tell you, it was amazing what all the staff did, and the judge, and everybody was great, and it was safe. We all wore masks, and I was very proud to be a Board of Governors member and a DC trial lawyer, because I thought it went amazingly well. So I can say from firsthand that we're back, and justice is accessible to everyone. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'm so glad it everything went well. A lot of staff helping to make it happen. Really. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's great to hear that ringing endorsement. All right. I think we are now moving to our third agenda item, and that is consideration of our consent agenda, which includes the draft minutes of the March 8th, 2022 meeting. Any comments or edits for the meeting? Meeting minutes, rather?
Chad?
Ellen, I see your hand.
Ellen. Yeah, I have one. In the report of the budget committee, I think we need to change it. Reports the license, the proposed license fee increases. And for inactive bar members, it lists $2, but that should be $3. That's my only change.
I think we should be able to make that revision. I think we can undertake a vote on the minutes with that edit made. If there is a motion to approve the minutes as edited.
So moved.
Second.
And I hear a second. All those in favor, please say aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, the draft meeting minutes are passed. And with that, I'll turn to you, Bob, for the president's report.
All right, thanks, Chad. On our operational status, the bar building remains open. Staff is still primarily remote, although some folks come in once or twice a week. We are gearing up for hybrid operations beginning on Monday, May 2nd. Managers have a lot of flexibility in working with their teams to determine what will work best. Presence in the building, be able to work remotely, or some combination thereof. We're going to slowly ramp up hybrid programming with in-person and virtual components. And we have a number of things already planned for the late spring and early summer. Again, mostly small things, but we are working our way back into the building. As Chad also mentioned, we are planning for an in-person board meeting in June 14th, which will be the last meeting of this board term and also the last meeting of the fiscal year. Following the meeting, we'll have a reception up on the 8th floor. So we're looking forward to seeing all of you, hopefully in person. You're going to hear shortly from the chair of the nominations committee, but I'm just going to remind you that the election for new members of the board, officers, and ABA delegates opens at noon on April 28th and runs through June 1st. We're opening it up on noon instead of midnight to give us a little bit more time because we're flipping the switch on our new association management system at the same time. And we want to make sure all goes according to plan. Like the past several years, all voting is going to be online and members will receive an email that allows them to click and vote, but they can also log into their dcbar.org accounts and vote that way as well. Chad mentioned the special meeting on April 27th. We hope that you can all join us. So far, 430 people have registered, although we expect there will be some attrition that normally occurs with a meeting like this. But still, we're not worried at all about making the 100-member quorum. Chad mentioned the president's reception. We've got the celebration of leadership set for June 23rd at the Renaissance Hotel. We're hoping to see all of you there as well. 2 weeks ago, we were visited by a representative of the New Jersey State Bar Association, a gentleman by the name of Robert Spangler. Yes, everyone from New Jersey has Robert and SP in their name. Bob is both the CIO and the COO of the New Jersey State Bar Association. He came to see how we were gearing up for our hybrid programming and to discuss a wide range of topics, how they were doing hybrid, how we're doing hybrid, cybersecurity, COVID safety protocols. I mean, it was great because we got into the nuts and bolts. And we had folks from our IT team and our facilities team to really share kind of what the best practices are as we're opening up building. It also presented an opportunity that we're going to now start to build joint programming with New Jersey. They are a voluntary bar, not a mandatory bar, and they do a fair amount of CLE and other programming. And we have a lot of overlapping members. So we thought that we would start to work on some joint programming. So it's a great opportunity. I'm very happy to report we have start dates for our two newest staff leaders. Kelly Neptune is going to begin her tenure as the executive director of the DC Bar Pro Bono Center on May 23rd. She'll actually come on in a temporary status a couple of weeks before that as she's wrapping up her time at Howard University. And she will be attending the ABA's Equal Justice Conference the second week of May as the new leader of the Pro Bono Center. But her formal first day full-time will be May 23rd. And Pam Robinson, she's going to take over as the Director of Communities on May 16th. You've got their short bios and announcements in your materials, and the longer version are available on the website. And we are so excited to have both of these experienced and visionary leaders joining our team. Speaking of the Pro Bono Center, it's that time of year when we need to file the 990 for the Pro Bono Center. Our auditors, the staff have completed and reviewed the form. which now goes to the Finance Committee for its review. And then we're going to share it with all of you for you to take a look at it before we file it. And it does need to be filed before May 15th. So keep an eye on your email for the Form 990 that'll come your way. Sticking on the Pro Bono Center topic, I have a farewell in the Pro Bono Center. Vanessa Batters-Thompson, who's not on this call because she's on spring break this week, but she is leaving the Pro Bono Center to take over as the executive director of DC Appleseed. Vanessa came to the Pro Bono Center in 2014 as a managing attorney, and her focus has been mostly on family law. She also took over the Advocacy and Justice Clinic. And in January of 2021, she was promoted to an associate director. And during her tenure, the Advocacy and Justice Clinic placed more than 2,000 clients living on low incomes with pro bono counsel in housing, family law, public benefits, and consumer matters. And volunteers just this year have helped clients seal, under her direction, 173 prior eviction records, which is a new benefit that the district has adopted. Vanessa also spearheaded the creation and development of the Family Law Assistance Network in partnership with other legal service providers. And they're offering DC-based individuals free legal advice on representation in custody, child support, parentage, and divorce cases. Under her supervision, the program really has grown and added staff attorney and a program specialist, and we received funding from the DC Bar Foundation to work on that program. Vanessa also took on management of the Pro Bono Center's training program a few years ago. And as all of you know, we've set records with the number and diversity of the training programs that we've put on in the past 2 years. Vanessa's been a really valuable teammate, a reliable collaborator, and a great friend to her colleagues. As Daryl put it, her deft touch and longstanding legal services background will be missed. However, our friends at DC Appleseed will gain a great leader who manages with vision and empathy. And I could not agree more. So we wish her well. It's a great step up for Vanessa. And again, we will miss her, but she's off to bigger and better things.
It sounds like we give it and take it away there a little bit at the Pro Bono Center right now. I guess the cavalry's coming, but Vanessa, what a tremendous loss. That's absolutely the case, but wow, yeah. Congratulations.
It really was. And it's you can't begrudge anybody a wonderful opportunity like leading DC Appleseed, which does amazing work. On the other hand, we can mourn the gap that we're going to have for a little while. And yep. I've spoken to Kelly and she knows what's going on and she's going to reach out to Vanessa directly and get some transfer of knowledge before she walks out. So,
I know you know how to manage that change at the center. That's great to hear.
Yeah. So that's my report. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer.
All right. If there are no questions for Bob, then moving to our next agenda item, it's my pleasure to welcome Robert Weiner to the meeting and to give us a bit of an update with regard to the 2022 ABA mid-year meeting.
Thank you. Welcome. I feel welcome here. I always enjoy being with the board. The American Bar Association held a virtual meeting again this year. It had to pivot at the last minute from an in-person meeting because of the Omicron surge. One of the most important pieces of business was the nomination of a new president-elect. And it was a hotly contested race. The winner was Mary Smith. She is an enrolled member of the Cherokee Nation, has served as chief executive of the Indian Health Service, general counsel of the Illinois Department of Insurance, and an in-house counsel at a Fortune 500 company. She worked previously in the Justice Department and the White House, and she is the first Native American president of the ABA. The ABA's also been outspoken on the issue of voting rights, and three of the resolutions that the House of Delegates considered at its mid-year meeting addressed those issues. One recommended changes in the Electoral Count Act, which governs how the Senate and House count the votes of presidential electors. The proposed reforms seek to avoid the type of controversy that surrounded the counting of votes in the last election. The House also adopted a resolution opposing legislation that undermines voting rights, including, for example, by imposing burdensome voter ID requirements, decertifying election results without justification, purging voting rolls, and allowing harassment of election officials. And a third resolution urged that all people be included in the count used for the apportionment of seats in the House of Representatives. Now, the House also passed 22 other resolutions. These are proposed by ABA committees, commissions, sections, as well as state and local bar associations. And these are important because the ABA can only file amicus briefs or advocate for legislation or urge regulatory changes when the House of Delegates has adopted a policy on the specific issues. And among those resolutions was one by the Standing Committee on Legal Aid and Indigent Defense, which Ted Howard used to chair. And it proposed 10 guidelines for residential eviction laws. The report on the guidelines explained how the consequences of evictions dictate that states and municipalities encourage settlements and minimize displacement and housing insecurity. The DC Bar, I know, has done a great deal of work in this area. Another resolution urged jurisdictions to allow court decisions on pretrial release with the presumption of innocence by not using risk assessment tools that and algorithms that reflect conscious or unconscious racial and economic bias. The ABA's Commission on Immigration proposed a number of resolutions as well. One dealt with the elimination of bias, discrimination, and xenophobia in the enforcement of immigration laws. Another addressed reform of the asylum system to afford transparency, due process, access to counsel, and full affair and fair adjudication of asylum claims. And a third urged support for Afghan refugees. Now, this is just a sample of the 25 resolutions that the House adopted. I'm happy to address questions about these or any of the other resolutions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that report, Robert. Any questions? Well, thank you also for representing our you know, sort of the DC Bar's interests and equities in these matters, all of which are so important and timely. And let's hope that they can have some salutary effect on some of the challenges that exist and certainly lie ahead. Very much appreciate your presentation, though.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. I see our next agenda item then relates to a report from the Attorney-Client Arbitration Board and concerns that proposed amendment that we've heard a bit about in the past. So for that, I'll turn to Charles McCullough.
Thank you, and good morning, President Cercio, and may it please the Board of Governors. I'm an 18-year member of the DC Bar, member of the inaugural cohort of the John Peyton Leadership Academy, and I come to you today as chair of the Attorney-Client Arbitration Board. Thank you all for considering the proposed ACAB interim rule for procedure for conducting the remote ACAB arbitration hearings. The interim rule seeks to clarify and codify within the ACAB rules of procedure authority already exercised by our sole arbitrators and chairpersons under DC Official Code Section 164415. The portion of the DC Code granting arbitrators the authority to conduct an arbitration in the most appropriate manner for a fair and expeditious disposition of the proceeding. I will begin by providing some background to refresh your knowledge about ACAB. Then I'll review how the pandemic brought the need for this rule to the forefront. And then finally, I'll discuss this, how this rule ensures ACAB is able to maintain a fair and accessible arbitration process, all in a lawyer's 5 minutes. By the way of background, the Attorney Client Arbitration Board provides an informal arbitration service for resolving fee disputes between members of the bar and their clients. Either the client or the lawyer may request an arbitration, assigned a sole arbitrator for disputes under $10,000 or a chaired three-person panel for disputes exceeding this amount. The ACAB arbitration service is an informal, quick, and efficient means of resolving fee disputes. ACAB arbitrations are typically completed within 6 months of filing, while litigation may take years. ACAB arbitration awards are binding on both parties to a dispute, with a limited right of appeal before the DC Superior Court, which itself has hybrid and remote proceedings. In fiscal year 2020-2021, ACAB opened 38 cases, concluded 31 cases, and issued arbitration awards resolving approximately $2 million in disputed legal fees. Prior to the pandemic, arbitrations were conducted in person at the DC Bar headquarters. There is no rule mandating that these arbitrations be conducted in person. So, on occasion, sole arbitrators or panel chairs made the determination that a party could participate in an arbitration electronically, which at that time meant phone. This decision was typically made when a requesting party had logistical or health challenges that prevented their in-person presence. Our arbitrators pride themselves on maintaining accessibility. So you can imagine when the pandemic forced the closing of the DC Bar headquarters, maintaining accessibility meant quickly adjusting by conducting ACAB hearings virtually by Zoom. For the past 2 years, all ACAB hearings have been held virtually. For attorneys and clients, this presented unexpected benefits. Scheduling was made easier because both attorneys and clients no longer had to account for such things as travel to and parking at the DC bar, or taking off a full day of work, or childcare issues. For similar reasons, it was easier for us to assign arbitrators, some of whom live outside of the metropolitan area. To ensure all participants were comfortable with Zoom, ACAB developed written tutorials and staff began offering Zoom walkthroughs. With regard to arbitrator preparedness, ACAB's best attended training to date happened during the pandemic when we offered a webinar on best practices for conducting Zoom-based hearings. Our arbitrators are well prepared to conduct virtual hearings, and anecdotal evidence shows that attorneys and clients enjoy the option. This brings us to why we're here this morning. As the pandemic is easing and we begin the process of reopening the DC bar offices, ACAB feels that the ACAB rules of procedure should more formally acknowledge the option of conducting hearings virtually and the authority that the sole arbitrators and chairs already have in making that decision. That proposed rule states, again, that at the discretion of the sole arbitrator or chairperson, ACAB hearings may be conducted by way of remote hearing, either telephonically or using video conference technology. The precise method in which a remote hearing will be conducted remains the discretion of the sole arbitrator or chairperson assigned to the individual case within the bounds of applicable law, rules, and these rules of procedures. So this rule is necessary because as the DC bar opens its offices, we are aware that not all attorneys, clients, or arbitrators may be vaccinated or boosted to the extent they are able to enter our facilities. Some may not be ready for in-person hearings that require several people to be in close personal proximity. And still others may find that virtual attendance allows them the ease, comfort, and flexibility in their work or their life schedule to fully participate in arbitrations. So we ask that you approve the proposed rule today so that it is in place when the DC bar offices open more broadly. Please note that in approving this proposed interim rule, the work of ACAB Accessibility and Rules Committees will continue. From the ACAB Accessibility Committee, this work includes launching an arbitration participant survey this spring so that we can gather even more feedback regarding our hearings and how we can improve them. From the ACAB Rules Committee, this work includes reviewing survey feedback as well as other ongoing research that they're doing regarding virtual hearings to see if it's necessary to come back and recommend to this body in 18 months supplemental rules and language regarding virtual hearings. But in the interim, approving this rule allows ACAB to continue to offer virtual hearings in a manner that meets the needs of attorneys and clients. On behalf of the 11 members of the Attorney-Client Arbitration Board, our 17 mediators, our 101 volunteer arbitrators, and most importantly, the dozens and dozens of attorneys and clients benefiting from the fair and accessible arbitration process provided by the DC Bar, I thank you for your consideration. And for the foregoing reasons, I respectfully request the Board of Governors approve the proposed rule.
Charles, thank you very much for that succinct and thorough explanation, both the history and just the thoughtful work that you've done to set us up for some success in this space, because it's obviously so critical. Any questions for Charles? Sally, I see you've got a hand up.
No, that was an applaud, because I thought the report was very concise and very instructive. That's all. Sorry.
A lawyer's 5 minutes.
It was great. It was great.
Thank you.
We're not very good at math, so it's all good. That's right. Any questions? Anything else for Charles? I do see a hand up, Roger.
Hey, Charles, thanks for that really helpful survey. And I think you've really helpfully set out all the positive benefits. I was wondering if anyone has complained about not being able to come back in person and have these arbitrations, and whether or not there were any adverse impacts on your ability to meet resolutions or to resolve some of these disputes based on the fact that you weren't in person. I know it can be intangible, the benefits of being face-to-face, but I'm wondering if you noticed any trends in that regard.
Right. And, you know, just like with any service, you always hear the high highs or the low lows. But what's very strange, Roger, is that I haven't heard any low lows regarding a clamoring to get back into the office, into the facility, neither from attorneys. And granted, we don't necessarily see regular attorneys. We would hope not to see attorneys regularly when it comes to fee disputes, but definitely from our clients. And we would hear that. It would be in the beginning, oh, we would like to come in. Why can't we come in? But we're not hearing that. Actually, we're hearing the opposite. We're hearing a lot about the benefits of not having to take a whole day off of work, because hearings can go anywhere from 2 hours to the whole day. We have multiple day hearings sometimes. So we advise clients and attorneys to take off the whole day. But of course, for a client to take off the whole day can mean a detriment to their paychecks. No, we haven't heard that. And then as far as being able to be the conduct of the meeting, has there been any adverse impact? Again, anecdotally, I've not heard any adverse impact. In fact, what we are able to do, because we do have the Zoom technology, it's easier for us to share a lot of these documents. We're not shuffling through papers as much. We're able to put this stuff up on the screen, take in these documents electronically, share them electronically. And because we are on Zoom, we actually have less talking over each other. Because you can't, in a room across a table, you get that. But in Zoom, truly no one can hear each other when we're talking across. Kathleen, do you have anything to add to that? Perhaps staff has heard something that I haven't.
I think you covered everything, Charles. You did a great job. We have had really positive, a really positive experience though overall. And in the beginning, we were concerned, obviously, about the accessibility issue. You know, would people be able to meaningfully and fully participate in these proceedings remotely? And they have, you know, even if it's with their cell phone, they truly have been able to do that. And we've been able to not just hear them, but see them, which is, you know, nice to see people's faces as well. And with Zoom has just been really user-friendly for us. And with the breakout rooms and the waiting rooms, we've been able to offer opportunities for parties to still reach settlements. It's really been quite amazing, frankly.
Yeah. And I think one benefit that you mentioned settlement, Kathleen, is that the parties, I believe, especially on the client And there seems to be a little bit more of an ease, because even though they're not going into a courthouse, they're still, and we emphasize to them that that we're not going to be an overburden with procedure process. But still, you can see it when it was in person, there was a lot of tense, you know, feelings, looks. And I think being able to participate in the comfort of your home, or maybe in the closed door of your office, but in the space of your choosing, whatever that space is, there's more comfort, I believe, for the client. So I think that has also been something that's helped the process.
Well, Charles, Kathleen, thank you so much for, pun intended, having this dialed in so well, and for figuring out just what's right for the process and the people involved. As you can see from the agenda, I proposed waiving our traditional two-meeting policy so that we could take expedited action with regard to the amendment of these rules of procedure. And so for that reason, I'd be happy to entertain a motion in support of the amendment.
Move to support the amendment.
Thank you, Megan. Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
I hear one. All those in favor, please say aye or raise your hand.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Well, then, Charles, Kathleen, I'm happy to say that the Board of Governors has approved your proposed rule amendment. And so congratulations and thanks for all the fabulous work that you've done and will continue to do.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Have a very good meeting. Goodbye.
Appreciate that. All right. Well, it's my pleasure then to turn now to Donna Atanasio to give us a report of the Committee on Nominations.
Thank you. And I will apologize in advance. My internet is usually excellent. Today it's cut out twice since this meeting began. So I hope it will hold for the next few minutes. So first of all, I want to thank all of you for having had the opportunity to serve as the chair of the Nominations Committee. This truly was an exceptional experience. I really enjoyed having this ability to serve the bar in this way. And I want to give particular thanks to Chad and to Bob, Aram, and Crystal, and the other members of the DC Bar who supported this process and made it about as smooth and painless as possible. So first of all, the nominations committee, it included a very diverse group of DC Bar members trying to represent all of the different sectors of the bar. They had varied professional backgrounds and practice types and areas. The nominations committee consisted of myself. I'm with GW Law School, and so representing academia. We had Tanya Butler Truesdale from the DC government, Sonia Murphy from the federal government, Amisha Patel from Deckert, a large law firm, Seth Price from a small firm, solo practice, Bill Rivera representing the in-house sector, and Tricia Monroe from Legal Aid. We began our work in October, and we met regularly to discuss the nominations and to keep abreast of where we were having, you know, slower nominations coming in and where we were robust. This year, unlike previous years, I understand, the committee had the benefit and support of a stellar marketing campaign. I really can't thank the DC Bar staff enough for putting this together. It was excellent. It included, in particular, video testimonials, which came from several of you, the current and some former Board of Governor members. Those were really important. One of the most frequent questions that we received from potential candidates was, well, what does this really involve? What's it like? So again, thank you so much for all of those who contributed that. It was really beneficial to helping us develop a solid slate of candidates. The campaign that they developed, the marketing campaign that the staff developed, utilized all of the bar's various channels to reach our members. Those certainly paid off. Among other things, they created flyers that made it very easy for us and others, friends, to post things on LinkedIn, send them out by email. So it was a really excellent marketing campaign. I think that paid off in terms of the quantity and quality of the nominees that we received. For president-elect, we had 3 candidates this year to choose from. From the Board of Governors, we had 29 nominees. Most of them were self-nominated. 3 were incumbents. 4 came from the staff, Board of Governors or JNC members, and 1 from the nominations committee. They comprised very diverse and highly qualified members. It was extraordinarily difficult to sort through this extraordinary slate of candidates. Necessarily, we had to trim the slate. We want to be sure that we have majority or you know, as the case may be for candidates where we have fewer, but we want to have robust segments of the electorate behind them. So we did narrow it as required and as appropriate. For the ABA delegates, in addition to the three incumbents, there were nine self-nominations. So the slate that we delivered to the secretary, which has already been done, included two candidates for each of the offices of president-elect, secretary, and treasurer. We put forth 13 candidates for the five at-large Board of Governors seats, but two of those candidates have since withdrawn after evaluating their current obligations and their ability to carry forward. So that left us, of course, with a seat of 11 candidates. You have the slate of candidates in your board materials. There's one additional substantive item that I want to raise for you. The Nominations Committee recommends and asks the board to approve the reappointment of June Kress as a non-lawyer member for another 3 years. I know she's here, and you've also worked with her for 3 years, so I don't think I have to speak to her qualifications, but there are details in the materials that you received. I think with that, I've concluded what I need to do, and Chad, I turn it over to you so that we can move on the nomination of June Kress.
Thanks very much for that report. And here's how we'll proceed on that very hotly debated and controversial reappointment of our own June Kress. We'll just undertake that at the end of our executive session. So you just give everyone an opportunity for discussion and a vote, and that way you can just drop June and it'll be a clean process for you too. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
All right. No, thank you very much, Donna, for that helpful information. And I agree with you. It was really a great process this year. And I think it was really all about the people. We had such a wonderful team there. And I'm sure we'll have some lessons learned going forward. And it'll be even better next year on your watch, Ellen. All right. So with that, then, I will turn to you, Mark Salzberg, for a report on the latest work of the Regs and Rules Committee.
All right, thanks, Chad. Good afternoon, everybody. As you may recall, we were here last month with a little preview of what we were going to request the Board of Governors to do today, which is to approve the bylaws. Just to kind of summarize, we've been at this process since November of 2020. We've worked with Nancy Sylvester, our parliamentarian residents. We've had four presentations to the board, bringing the Board of Governors up to date. We've had one amendment passed or approved already concerning the number of Board of Governor meetings. A memorandum was submitted to the board on March 8th with a final proposed version of the bylaws attached to the motion. I'm sorry, attached to the memorandum along with a redlined version showing changes made to a prior version. And the memorandum, which was prepared by bar staff and Urim and her team in great detail, summarizes the changes that we're recommending to the bylaws. And in essence, again, we were guided by a number of principles in this project, including addressing inconsistencies, streamlining the bylaws, and removing administrative details and placing them in other documents, including the membership manual and committee charter documents. We addressed some questions that were posed by board members, specifically one regarding the discretion of the CEO to address membership issues. That's in section 3.07 of the proposed bylaws. We've addressed other questions concerning the new treasurer-elect and quorum details. I would open up the floor to questions about the proposed bylaws if there are any remaining issues.
Any questions for Mark with regard to the work of the Regs Rules Committee in adjusting and amending our bylaws? I can tell you, having sort of sat on the factory room floor for so much of this work, it has been an incredible undertaking. Mark's leadership, Urim's guidance, some of the technical support participation from Nancy, our outside consultant, all the hard work, sifting and sorting and editing and drafting by so many of the bar staff, the thoughtful contributions from the members of this board. It was something to behold. It is something I think we could be glad that we are nearing the end of the road about. And so any last questions or concerns from this group with regard to what's what you saw in the materials? If not, we do have before us the opportunity to vote, and I'd entertain a motion to adopt the revised bylaws and the membership manual, I should say.
So moved.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
I hear second. One. All those in second. Favor, please say aye. Raise your hand.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right, hearing none, then congratulations, Mr. Salzberg. That is quite an accomplishment and quite a lot of effort that went into it. The entire community is to be commended.
Thank you, Chad. Thank you to all the bar staff. Thank you to Aram and thank you to Nancy. I never thought I would know so much about Robert's rules of, dumb tools. But thank you for the board also for helping us go through this in a process that enabled a vote today. So thank you.
Not at all. Thank you, Mark. Really appreciate all of your Herculean efforts to get that to see that through.
All right. Take care.
Absolutely. You as well. All right. It's my pleasure now then to turn to our president-elect for a budget committee report.
Thank you very much, Chad. I have two items that require a vote from the board today. The first thing that I will take up is the approval of our fiscal year 22-23 budget. Just to set the stage, we first presented the budget at the March board meeting. At that time, we needed to focus on the license fee increases for the following year. So we approved a $4 increase for active members, which brought our fees from $320 to $324. And a $3 increase for our inactive members, bringing their license fees from $199 to $202. There was no change to the judicial members, and that was approved. And we had to take that up earlier, as you may recall, because we needed to make sure we complied with the bylaw rule that there was 45 days after the board voted before it came into effect. And we needed that change to come into effect before the May 1st license fee renewal schedule. So that was done at the March meeting. In your materials are in your board packet are the materials relating to the proposed budget for this coming year. Same materials that we presented for the March meeting. Just a quick recap. This budget was put together by the committee to reflect the board's commitment to the priorities of our strategic plan, our duty to spend the bar resources responsibly, and the impact of the current inflationary environment on our staff and our operations. As folks may recall, at the time we were considering this back in March, we were facing a 7% inflation, and the numbers just came out for March, it's up to 8.5%. So it is only going up, further putting pressure on our staff and making sure that we can compensate them so that it is both feasible and desirable for them to stay with the board. Retention of our amazing staff and our ability to recruit new staff, which as you see from Bob's report this morning, we have another spot we will need to fill for good reasons. As you say, it's always great to see one of our own go off to wonderful things. But we have to make sure that the bar is in a position to replace and hire for that position at the same high standards as we want to present to our members to keep our services high. So the budget that we presented in addition to the license fee increases, just to hit another highlight, it includes a 7% merit pool and a 2% pool for market adjustments. Again, recap of the process. This has been going on for quite a while. As Mark said about the bylaws process, the staff got together in the fall, going through budgets division by division. The budget committee members became involved in January. We set up liaisons to each of the divisions, went through those budgets individually with them. And then the budget committee got together, reviewed the whole proposal, had a lot of discussion on the license fee and the merit pool and came out with a budget that you see today. I want to thank our committee members, Andrea, Diane, Chad, Paul, Amy, and Alyssa Priam from the Professional Responsibility. They were just terrific, asked good questions, delved into the process, and I can't thank them enough, along with Marg and her staff, for their help in making sure that we present to the board today a budget that we feel is appropriate for the times and will help the bar to continue providing the great services to our members. So with that, I think I will stop and ask anyone on the committee or Marg if they would like to jump in. And obviously any questions the board has, we'll be happy to answer.
Well, while we're maybe giving folks an opportunity to collect any last thoughts, let me say, add my thanks to you, Ellen, for your leadership of the committee, having participated in the last 2 years' effort through the Budget Committee. I can say quite a different set of challenges in some ways and opportunities in others, and just a difficult set of decisions that the committee confronted. And I think you've done it with aplomb and really endorsed the work of the committee. It was a pleasure to be a part of it.
Thank you, Chad. And we appreciated your expertise having been through this process several years.
That's a word. I'm not sure it's the word I'd use, but it's a word.
I wanted to echo Chad's gratitude for Ellen. I think it's a form of hazing we implement for the president-elect, and Ellen weathered it with grace. I also wanted to just say a big shout out and thank you to Mark and the finance team for making this process incredibly easy for those of us who are on the Budget Committee. And I think you all know how great Marg is and her staff, but they really do an amazing job every year putting together these materials, responding to the many questions and the many amendments that the committee asks for, and the many tweaks we ask them to make, which is not a simple undertaking. And they come back with promptly with updated and accurate materials and without complaint. And they're just a joy to work with. So huge thanks to the finance team.
Well said, Amy. The staff really cuts this beast down to size and makes this a manageable undertaking, while still large, a manageable undertaking. Any questions or concerns for Ellen or others in the committee? Hearing none, Ellen, do you want to call for a vote?
Absolutely. I am happy to make a motion on behalf of the Budget Committee that we approve the budget for the 2022-23 fiscal year.
Second.
Is there a second? I hear one. All those in favor, please say aye and raise your hand.
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Fabulous. Well, we have adopted another fabulous budget, and I'm sure that this will facilitate the bar's work in the year ahead. Thanks so much again, Ellen.
Thank you, Chad, and thank you to everyone. And again, thank you to the committee for all their hard work. I have one more piece of business, if I can still hold folks' attention. And this involves basically an approval for additional funding for our capital projects. As you may recall, the Budget Committee recommended an increase or an adjustment to increase our capital budget for this year based on some changes that we saw in terms of implementing the case management system. We came back in December at our December meeting and recommended an adjustment of $118,000 to the capital budget to fund the case management system for ODC. As you may recall, ODC had elected to stick with their case management system for this year, while BPR decided to move forward with migrating to the new system. And once ODC saw how great that was and how well it was working, they wanted to jump on the bandwagon and do it this year. The upside for us was that it reduced the overall cost because we saw some efficiencies to doing it all this year as opposed to spreading it out and doing BPR this year and ODC next year. Now I'm coming back. The Budget Committee has spoken with Marg and with Katerina Lupi, our Information Technology Director, and there have been some tweaks along the road to implementing not only our case management system, but the association management system. In the course of implementing these and rolling them out, there are some unforeseen expenses that we could not anticipate at the time. They total approximately $340,000, and the breakdown is $70,000 for BPR, and that involves migrating the documents in their current document management system to the new system. There were some tweaks in how they were stored and how they needed to be migrated to the new system that has resulted in a projected increase of about $70,000. ODC, we're projecting an increase of about 200,000. And this really relates to some enhancements to the project that once ODC saw how it was going to be implemented and the options that were available with the new system, they decided that they wanted to add different features that would enhance the effectiveness of the system going forward. And these are not frivolous add-ons. These are add-ons that will really enhance the operation of the case management system and will result in much easier implementation and much more transparency of the information and ability to access it. We've also discovered that for the association management project, again, we had some additional enhancements and some difficulties migrating the system from our old system to the current one that would result in costs of approximately $70,000 in addition. We have the budget committee, you know, asked appropriate questions, pushed and prodded here and there, and we have, we understand that this amount that we are asking for adjustment, $340,000, should anticipate and provide wiggle room if there are any, you know, other proposed tweaks that might come along. So with that, I will invite Mark or Katharina to add any more detail, and then hopefully we will be ready for a vote.
No.
Katharina, I think we were able to hear you.
Yeah, my connection has been going.
Now we hear you.
Out. Yeah. No additional detail, but I see Jeff has a hand raised. So anybody?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I understood that. Does this increase have anything to do with the fact that we have moved the project from next year's budget into this year's budget, or were these sort of unexpected issues that you've discovered, would those have been discovered anyway had this all been part of the FY22-23 budget instead?
It would have been the same. The only thing that maybe it would have happened is that we would have had more time for the discovery process of ODC. So maybe we would have known earlier. So we would have had some heads up. But it would not have made any difference. If anything, it would have been more expensive because we were splitting the project into parts. So this is really just the fact that when we got the quote for ODC, ODC was kind of an add-on to the existing project. So the discovery process was kind of short. Mm-hmm. And the vendor honestly thought, oh, we're doing BPR, we know what we're talking about. And they made assumptions. And then when they actually, you know, the rubber he started hitting the road, they realized that actually the ODC process are very complex and much more convoluted than the one of BPR, and therefore the actual cost was higher. So that's as simple as that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katharina. And Katharina has done a wonderful job working with BPR and ODC and, you know, making sure that they are happy and they have the functionality that they need in order to make sure that we can provide the services to our members. Roger, I see you. Go ahead.
I was going to say, just think it's fair to say, Ellen, that this, while sort of a short-term hit, this is still a long-term gain in terms of sort of an economy of scale, efficiency, and all of that with the process that we're following. So this is still very much a good news story, even if not quite as good as we started out believing.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Roger, you had a question.
Yeah, no problem. So it seems like these are some pretty significant increases, and I was wondering if the vendor had provided in their contract for prior approval of costs that exceed the original estimates, and if there was a process of negotiation, because in my experience, a data migration can be a complex process, but it is strike me, I'm having some sticker shock here. So I'm sure you've asked those relevant questions already. And so sorry if I'm repeating ground that's already been.
Yes, there is an approval process. There is an approval process, and they know, actually, I have some work orders in my mailbox that are waiting for the approval of this board. But we work very closely with the vendor, so it's not like they run off and they come back and they say, oh, send me $70,000 more. The biggest challenge is that we are migrating from a proprietary document management system, and without going into much detail, it was like, essentially as if the document had been shredded and we had to put them back together. This is it was the electronic version of it. And it is an intentional thing that the vendors do. The vendor we are migrating from, because they make it so painful to move out of their system that people just give up. We're not giving up, but it comes to a cost.
Okay, thanks for that.
Well, this too is an action item. If there are no other questions or concerns to raise to the Budget Committee or to Katarina, I'll solicit a motion to adopt these additional costs and to fund them.
I'm happy to so move, Chad, on behalf of the Budget Committee.
Thank you, Ellen. Is there a second?
Thank you. One.
All those in favor, please say aye. Raise your hand.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any objections from the board? All right, hearing none, you've adopted that. And Katarina, you have additional support to move forward with the incredible process. Envy you.
Well, the CMVPR will be happy that we can actually do what they need for their own job. So because they were the one, what happened if they don't give us the money? So they were the most concerned about this process. So I appreciate it on their behalf. Thank you.
I suspect this will be a classic love-hate story. You hate it while you're going through it, but you love it once it's done. All right. With that done, then I think our last substantive matter on our agenda is with our general counsel, Iram Mirza, who will talk to us a little bit about our proposed DC bar policy on public statements. Iram.
Thanks, Chad. Good afternoon, everyone. So there's a memo that accompanies the draft DC bar policy on public statements that outlines kind of all the major points. But just by quickly way of background, I think many of you, if not all of you, are familiar with what gave rise to this policy. Probably since I got here, the board has had three occasions where they've grappled with these issues as to when to make a public statement, whether to make a public statement, and what that statement should look like. So what we've endeavored to do here is kind of codify that process, outline the factors that the executive committee and the board ought to consider when making a decision about making public statements, so that there's consistency in the approach, in the application of those factors, and the process with various assents, or if we don't have certain assents, what would take place in those instances. I'm happy to answer any questions about the policy before you. And those are my only points. So I'll stop now.
Any questions for Iram? Okay, well, hearing none, this is again an action item for us. So again, I'd be happy to welcome a motion in support of the proposed revised policy.
I so move.
Second.
Is there a second? Okay. All those in favor, please say aye. Raise your hand.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. That motion carries as well. Thank you so much, Ira. Again, I know that's a long time in coming.
Thanks, Chad.
And thank this will really gratify that for 6 months. Yeah, it'll really streamline things moving forward. Thank you. All right. With that said, we are at that point in our agenda where I think we're ready for executive session. And with that, I'll thank for those who are dropping off the call. Thank you very much for your participation and your patience today. I look forward to seeing you soon. Maybe in three dimensions.
I'm just checking the list here.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay, I think we're good.
All right, well, I guess I'll formally call us to order an executive session and immediately turn it right back to you, Bob, for a discussion of the refinancing of the mortgage at the bar.
Sure, thanks, Chad. So this is in the nature of a heads up. As you know, we have a very large mortgage with Truist, formerly known as SunTrust, for the building. When we obtained this mortgage, it was based